Hey, everybody, this is Dr. Karen Kelsky of The Professor Is In, and I am really glad that you are joining us for the podcast. I'm excited about all of the things that we've been able to talk about and the issues we've been able to address on the podcast. Cal and I have a really good time doing it, even when we're talking about hard subjects. Right now, because of the COVID-19 pandemic, Cal and I feel that there is literally nothing more important than community. And so one of the things that the podcast offers is the premium community page. And we are looking forward to having a lot more community conversation and offerings and member-only podcast episodes over there. So we'd really love it if you would join us. So please do find us on the Himalaya app. That's the only app where you can become a premium member. And you can, of course, listen to all of your regular podcasts there as well. Thanks a lot.
Hey, everyone. This is Kel Weinhold from The Professor Is In.
And this is Dr. Karen Kelsky from The Professor Is In. And we are so happy that you are here with us today, joining us again on another episode of The Professor Is In podcast. This time, of course, coming to you from the ever-intensifying COVID-19 pandemic.
Yes. If you want to follow along with us as we do this in real time, you can follow The Professor Is In at Professor Is In, not the, but Professor Is In on Twitter. You can come to the very active Facebook page, which is The Professor Is In on Facebook. You can also check out the blog where we post new material every day, every weekday, from a range of voices. Check that out. And you can also catch up with me on Twitter and Instagram at KELWEINHOLD. And I think that's all the ways you can find us.
So speaking of social media, yesterday I put something on Facebook and Twitter about the number of campuses that have announced hiring freezes or pauses. Mm-hmm. And my counting of those started the day before, just very impressionistically hearing stories starting to trickle in. And once I put out a call on social media for people to share if their campuses had announced a freeze, I quickly assembled, I think, about 55 campuses, mostly in the U.S., a few in Canada, a couple overseas. And so I put that on Facebook and then put it on Twitter. And starting with me, and then at people, all of our readers are really, really reeling from this realization. Really, really reeling from a realization. A lot of
like that sound today.
At the losses that are accruing, aside from the ones that we're facing right now, we have been facing the last month or so, but the ones that now we're looking at over the short and medium term future.
I think we were looking at that loss earlier in the loss of campus visits. And not the ones that are canceled. And we certainly heard from people about their campus visits being canceled, but the people who went from planes booked, hotels booked, going to go spend 2 days visiting with people, having dinner, all of those things, to anywhere from a 2 hour to a 6 or 7 hour Zoom campus visit. Mm-hmm. Visit in quotes.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely been something that you have been more directly involved with. Because of doing all of your interventions,
right.
Your campus visit interventions.
Suddenly in the span of a few days, appointments went from, okay, how to talk to the dean to how do I do what a physical presence does? Because a physical presence makes a big difference.
Sure.
In terms of how we sell ourselves. And I don't mean that in the basis terms. I really just mean it in the relationship terms. Mm-hmm. Of how do we engage people.
Right.
With our physical selves. And when that's gone and we have this two dimension and this thing that you finally got, you finally got the prize, you're going to campus. And and that's not even talking about the clients that have been in touch who they were just canceled.
Right. Well, then, and I might also add the difficulty and the stress of having to accept a job based on a campus visit that you did where you didn't get to see campus. And you do have to, presumably, accept if you're interested in the job, you have to accept it sight unseen at this point. That's has become the norm.
Yeah, I did see a couple people saying that they were then going to be invited in May or June to come to campus just to see everything. I think, you know, we can flip it around to the faculty side too. Imagine being a faculty member and trying to make a decision about someone joining your department and you haven't had a chance to really see how they move and operate in space. Mm-hmm. And think about how the way we move in space so completely informs our experience.
Yep,
we're not,
absolutely.
We don't sit in front of a computer staring at the camera.
No.
And so anyway.
Yeah. So losses have been accruing steadily.
Right.
And of course, I mean, it goes without saying that there are many, many more, even more profound losses that you out there in listener land are undoubtedly dealing with. Some of you have actually lost your jobs. You have lost your feelings of normalcy. You've lost the ability to send your kids away so that you can get work done. You've lost your productivity. And that's actually more of what we talked about last time, coping with the loss of productivity. And I'm probably, you know, missing a bunch of other loss of freedom to move freely about the country and move freely about space. I mean, we're all experiencing, but certainly not on an equitable level. Some are much more than others, but everybody is experiencing levels of losses that I think we're not even in a position to be able to enumerate yet because we're so deep in the thick of it.
I also am just so aware of our international clients who are unable to get home.
Right. Of course.
And right now, I realize that many of us wouldn't have the resources to do it. But right now, if you lived and worked in California and your family members were in, you know, Illinois or Pennsylvania, you could get to them. You know, again, you'd have to have the car and all of that. But there is this, like, I have the ability to get to them.
Right.
If you are working in the U.S. and your family is in Spain or in Germany or in South Africa, or you can't get there.
Right.
And you may be in a situation where people can't get to you.
Mm-hmm.
So either way.
Yeah.
But all of those, we just keep, what we were talking about today is how there was an article that came out today in the...
March 23rd.
Oh, right. 2 days ago. Sorry. I just saw it today. So it must have come out today because I saw it today. Anyway, this article that came out a couple days ago in the Harvard Business Review. And I say this all the time because I quote the Harvard Business Review a lot.
Do you really?
Yeah.
That's funny. I never do. So it felt really funny for me. I posted this on Facebook the day it came out because I had seen it on social media. And I was like, oh, gosh, I'm sharing something from Harvard Business Review. Don't beat me up.
So you're forgetting that the whole podcast that we did, that hasn't run yet because we keep bumping things because of COVID-19.
And we're going to keep bumping it now.
Right. So the Productivity Pyramid podcast we did. The Energy Project was a Harvard Business Review article from 10 years ago.
Right.
But anyway, we digress. Harvard Business Review does some really amazing work around productivity, around operating beyond just the what the name would sound like.
Right.
And what I think is amazing, this particular article is their editing staff meeting with David Kessler, who is a grief expert.
Mm-hmm.
And he's written extensively on grief. He's written with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. He's written on his own. He's written, you know, Finding Meaning. He's sort of the sixth stage going past Kubler-Ross's five.
Right. But in collaboration with her, not in any, in other words, building upon her work, not.
Yeah, the first book was with her, and then the second one he went on from there.
So it's called Finding Meaning, the sixth stage of grief.
And he's worked in hospitals, and he's worked with...
the LAPD for traumatic events, the Red Cross, disaster services team.
Anyway, that's enough on his pedigree. But the reason that it was so... I thought it was so interesting, and you and I both talked about it being interesting, is as you read through it, it was so clearly spoke to everybody that we know and work with, what they're going through.
Right.
What we were just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that the first challenge out of the box for the HBR article is like, is this really, I mean, can you really call this grief? What we're all feeling? We're all feeling these different things. And can you call it grief? And he says, yeah, because there are a number of different kinds of grief. And that's the thing that struck me, is like, it's not this single experience. Mm-hmm. Just like out there, all of you listening are having very different experiences. And we just enumerated a small number of them. And they're all griefs in some way.
And his point that he opens with is that we, each of us, is experiencing different kinds of griefs simultaneously,
right.
which is also making it very, very complicated
right.
and confusing
right.
because some of us may not be particularly comfortable with emotion anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so then it's like, well, okay, it's hard enough to identify even one emotion or one version of emotion. And now you're saying I'm supposed to like recognize that I might be feeling not just one grief, but three different kinds. But it was...
Or that the person next to me can't relate to any of them.
Right.
Right.
So I just want to say, I'm very excited to talk more about him because I found his ideas really so compelling that I actually sent them to the kids, believe it or not.
Mm.
And I said to them in the text, I know that the two of you don't really love discussing feelings or even maybe acknowledging them, but I found this rather helpful. And Miyako hearted it and Seiji wrote back and said, are you kidding me? I'm training to be a social worker. I acknowledge the presence of feelings.
And I said, well, you may. Good for you standing up for yourself, young man. Right. People making gross generalizations about you based on your 15-year-old self exactly. when you're a 19-year-old. You know, young man coming into his
own. But I did say, well, I meant with me because they don't exactly discuss feelings with me. Anyway,
Mom.
that was another digression. But yeah, you know, about 3 or 4 days ago, it was over the weekend. I think I told you about it. I woke up and I was flattened. And I haven't been that way so far. I've actually been kind of perky. And I sat there and I was trying to articulate to a friend of ours by text what I was feeling. And I kept saying, well, I feel kind of this lassitude. Of course I did.
You said, because if it's not an SAT word, it's right. not a conversation.
It's not a 3+ syllable word. I feel this ennui. I feel this. It's true. I use these words.
Moving on.
And then I said, finally, I feel sad. And it was like a bolt that went, you know, from my head to my toes. I feel sad. And it was freeing in a way. I mean, it was very devastating, but it also unlocked things so that the experience could begin to move and flow rather than being stuck. And I did eventually was able to get out of bed, but sad.
Mm-hmm.
Just identifying that. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, I just wanted to share my own experience, but... Back to the article.
No, I think it's woven into the article. And I think, I mean, one of the first things he talks about is anticipatory grief.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I thought that was really interesting about this within the academic experience is that every single person is anticipating a different type of grief.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if you already have a job and you work at a small university, which they're always financially struggling, and you're closed, you are at an extinction moment.
Yeah, extinction event.
And it's an extinction event, potentially an extinction event, and, mm-hmm. and that's a whole other terror.
Mm-hmm.
There are the big, robust universities where you're so used to that robustness, and they're closed, and if they don't get enough students back into the next round, the budget cuts are stunning. I mean, mm-hmm. they're just stupefying. We sit here and talk all the time about how they use undergraduate tuition to fund the whole thing and
right.
our problem with that and, you know, the bloated administration. I mean, but the down there is the incredibly rising cost of tuitions. And without them.
Right, because they're refunding some of the tuitions.
Right.
They're refunding housing
right.
For all the kids who had to move off campus. On a lot of campuses.
Lot
I know
of
some
campuses.
Of you haven't. I am absolutely, I want to talk about fear. I just want to make sure that we are cautious today to stay on grief. Fear can overcome grief very, very quickly.
Overwhelm it.
And then I'm not in touch with that feeling anymore at all. That's actually normative for me.
Right. So you go into fear and anxiety and skip the grief part, mm-hmm. which is a really common thing for people to go into fear and skip the underlying thing. And I think that he, in this article, that he uses the phrases of broadly imagined futures, that we have anticipatory grief for our broadly imagined futures. So we've been going along, and that's kind of why I was mentioning those two different kinds of universities, because mm-hmm. you may have been there a month ago having this broadly imagined future at your university or leaving your university or whatever it is. And that, that the grief is that sense of safety or that sense of a plan. And we could do the whole Buddhist thing or the whole whatever thing about, you know, people plan, God laughs. But I mean, that, that planning is just a way we imagine control. Mm-hmm. We couldn't control this. But rarely have we had an opportunity to see a massive worldwide, oh shit,
global pandemic.
Right.
And he says, in that same paragraph, he says something interesting. He says, also, it's a virus, which is invisible.
Right.
So you can't see it.
Right.
But you can see its effects, but you can't see it. And you see it move in waves across the world, across different countries, China, South Korea, Japan, Italy, making its way.
You only see it move because the news tells you it's happening.
Right.
So you're sitting in this weird liminal state, unless you're in New Rochelle, New York, or you're in, you know, you're in some of the, you're in Seattle, or you're in the massive outbreaks where,
New York City.
Yeah. That it's still surreal. And it's just, it feels like it's creeping to other places or waving through it. So I think that this invisible force that you only know by what your news source tells you.
Right.
And then terrifyingly, how many people are have news sources that are just, never mind.
Well,
I'm going to go down that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that is worth an illusion, is that since we are so reliant on news sources and social media, we're constantly having to come up against other people's radically different understandings of the level of threat we're under. And that's another fear slash grief moment. Wow. How did we end up so divided in this country? How did we end up with people who, you know, so many people are rejecting, you know, the words of scientists. Mm-hmm. There's a grief there for people who are scientists in particular. Wow. How did we lose control of this narrative so thoroughly over the last 20, 30, 40 years? But he also says the loss of, I just want to give a shout out to the other losses, the loss of normalcy, the loss of connection. Mm-hmm. We're not able to physically see our friends. Some of us can't even physically see our family members. A lot of the medical staff are posting pictures on social media of how they have quarantined themselves away from their children. Mm-hmm. And so they're visiting their children or visiting their elderly parents through a glass door. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a loss, and that's grief for sure.
I think it's really interesting how many of us, if we stopped and thought about it, how many of us are in the bargaining phase with this, the way that we're doing physical distancing. Because, you know, we have the 14 days for this or 15 days for that. And I know my own brain, and I know, watch people well enough to know that there is down there some level this, okay, I'm going to do this for 15 days and this is going to be over. And that constantly having to remind yourself that, you know, this is, you do this physical distance for 15 days and you may have some slight shifts, you know, like you and I, the whole physical distancing thing, because you are living with two kids who came home from college. So making sure that they, everybody, you know, times out with their 15 days with no infection anywhere, that may shift then what happens after that in terms of, you know, proximity to you and I to each other. But it's there's this magical thinking of, oh, next Sunday it's an all clear. And it's not an all clear.
Not at all.
And then we have the powers that be in this country saying, well, we need to have everything up and running by Easter because we'll have this under control, because it's just plain lying from the podium that the news just reports. As a former journalist, I have to say this reporting live someone lying is the most irresponsible thing. But anyway, I think that that phase of this bargaining, it's all going to be fine if we just do this. So, I mean, I know so many people who are in these moments of, okay, I'm willing to do this. You know, friends whose partners are in other cities who say, okay, I'm just going to stay here. And then after this, you know, after we're clear, then this.
Right.
But every day they're both out in worlds working where they are potentially exposed. So every day is a new reset on the 15th, right?
Exactly. It's like, you know, class punishment, or like the football team. You know, if one kid acts up, everybody has to be punished, and, you know, how
well, they don't have to be. That's what
people,
that's,
well, Seiji used to just get so mad. And in fact, you used to do that with the football team when you were the coach. Yeah. I don't find that problematic. I mean, that's part of team training, is that kids have to act.
There's a collective responsibility.
There's a collective responsibility. So I have no problem with that. But the thing that people keep trying shouting on social media is, do you understand that if you don't obey these rules, we all have to obey them longer?
Right.
So it's, we're a team. No.
Well, yeah,
we're
a team. It's like everybody's losing time. I saw it on Twitter. Somebody said, it's like we keep losing minutes of recess because you people will not stay home.
Exactly.
If everybody would just stay in their damn seat, Then we would get to have all of our minutes of recess.
So
but instead,
in fact, the lessons of kindergarten do in fact apply at the most critical moments of life.
Yes. Yes.
So just a reminder for any of our listeners who may not be familiar with the five stages of grief. I just realized we ran right past that, assuming everyone has read the Kubler-Ross famous book and of course has gone far
beyond
heard about it. But I just want to remind anyone who doesn't know that the first one is denial, where you say this isn't happening.
No, and we saw that forever.
90% of our country, or not 90, 50% of our country appears to still be in that. Anger. And actually, I'll just read what Kessler says. This virus won't affect us. That's denial. Anger. You're making me stay home and taking away my activities. And I would say taking away my liberties, which is one of the talking points of the other side. Bargaining, which Kel just talked about. Okay, if I social distance for 2 weeks, everything will be fine. Sadness. I don't know when this will end. And then acceptance. This is happening. I have to figure out how to proceed. So as you can imagine, given our agenda, our mission here on the podcast to help people, we are going to talk about acceptance.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the place that you want to get to, but I don't want to jump over that because
of course
the other thing, if you've read the book, is to understand that those five stages are not linear, right? You don't just get through one and get through another and get through another and get through another, and then you're totally acceptance and you don't go back to anger and you don't go back to this can't be that bad.
Right.
And I mean, think about
it. You cycle through them over and over for years sometimes.
In the span of this conversation, as we've talked about, you know, in 2 weeks, this isn't 2 weeks. I mean, when I said to you, you know, the bargaining portion of like 2 weeks, it's all going to be fine. You got this look on your face like, oh, like in somewhere in there was this, like, I haven't really accepted that this is months. This is a new world order. And I think that's the key grief, right? The acceptance part is starting to let in, it's not going to be the same.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to come out of this the same.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to, there's not a magic anything for this virus come May.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know that it won't be back, just like the flu in 18. So accepting that we have a new world order.
As in 1918.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure I knew.
Not H1N1,
the influenza epidemic of 1918 that wiped out.
The one that was incorrectly named the Spanish flu.
That
originated, I believe, from the reading that I've been doing in Kansas.
Uh-huh.
And then got misnamed. But anyway, because racism. Or xenophobia.
Mm-hmm.
Because xenophobia. The thing is that if we can figure out how to just admit this is how this is rolling out. This is how it's going. Now what? And you know, if you guys have listened to me on this, on Facebook Live, read my blog post, you're going to know, like Karen said, that my mantra is going to be, let's just deal with where we are. Let's just deal with where we are. And what will bring up that fear that keeps you away from your grief is when you start future casting about what's going to happen. So we could spend the rest of this podcast talking about the potential, even likely collapse, further collapse of the academic job market.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't do you a lot of good. It doesn't do us a lot of good for us to stir the fear pot.
Mm-hmm.
What would be the challenge is to say, how about you work on accepting that the academic job market is not going to be the same?
Mm-hmm.
Let's grieve that. Let's deal with that. And then you can start to have power to decide what you're going to do next.
Mm-hmm.
But if you keep being in denial,
right,
keep not accepting that this is just going to be different. Those canceled searches that you have on your spreadsheet.
Mm-hmm.
Are just a tip of the iceberg. Mm-hmm. There are levels of university funding and complexities that we just don't understand.
Right. Well, I heard of a new one today, which was a person who is on the tenure track tried to use some of her research funding. to, you know, her startup funds. Mm-hmm. And they said, no, sorry, it's all on lockdown.
Yeah, I heard from somebody back channel because they didn't want it mentioned where they were from. But all research funds have been taken back.
Uh-huh. Wow.
And they're using to keep the system afloat.
Right, right.
But everything that they, I mean, the university said, we're taking them all.
Yeah. So, you know, like you said, accepting that things will be different. Also, I do think that it's worth, and I know that this is asking a lot, and I'll just put it out there for you to just consider, but not even putting your mind to that future at all, mm-hmm. whether it's the same. I mean, it won't be the same, but even the saying, oh, it will be different. That's still making an anticipation of the future. And one of the things he says is come into the present. Mm-hmm. And, anticipatory grief is the mind going to the future and imagining the worst. To calm yourself, you want to come into the present. This will be familiar advice to anyone who has meditated or practiced mindfulness. But people are always surprised at how prosaic this can be. Name five things in your room. It's that simple. There's a dot picture of a dog, an old rug, a coffee mug, a chair, a computer. Breathe and notice. And that in and of itself does bring you back. I'm here, right here, right now, right here, right now. I'm
right.
fine.
Right.
Which is a meditation that you use all the time, mm-hmm. and that I used to use back when I was still dealing with my fear of flying. Mm-hmm. That I'd be in the air and there would be turbulence, and it was anticipatory. Well, terror that the plane was going down, and I'd be like, "Well, right here, right now, I'm fine. Mm-hmm. I'm just." Mm-hmm. My water glass is, you know, jittering a little bit, but that jiggling a little bit, but that's it. And mm-hmm. so, yeah. Or, you know, or maybe, and that's not to assume that everyone is fine. I mean, fine is a relative term. Fine is a relative term. That's not dismissing current in the moment struggles. But the job market is one of the future ones, not one of the present ones.
Mm-hmm. This is a little bit of a left turn, but I was thinking about it as you were saying that. That the thing I worry about with the, not that I worry about, but I just want to bracket the sort of right here, right now moment and seeing the things around you, which absolutely can bring you back to the present. And mm-hmm. it's a great tool to keep you out of future casting and fear. Mm-hmm. The bracket I want to put around that is for those of you who have experienced this level of trauma before. Who have been in situations where your daily life has been completely upended, where you don't know what's going to happen from day to day, where the threat is real. So whether that is refugee or physical violence or economic or a threat that is significant. I mean, everybody does not have a sort of, you know, slightly rocky path. Some of the folks that we work with have had very traumatic paths. Mm-hmm. And so this can really bring that up. So, mm-hmm. so I just want to bracket that we're talking about, you know, garden level fear. Mm-hmm. It's not garden level. I mean, it's a pandemic and it's terrifying. Mm-hmm. It's heightened fear. Mm-hmm. But for those of you for whom that sets off a deeper trauma and mm-hmm. it's very hard to stay out of that panicked place. Sometimes the whole, you know, just sit with it, mindfulness thing doesn't really work.
I did
hear about a technique the other day that, you know, not a therapist, not guaranteeing any of this, but I did hear about a technique the other day to balance it out. So you're trying to hold dual things. So if you are panicking and you can feel that in some part of your body, if you can get yourself to notice another part of your body that doesn't feel terrified, that isn't tied up in the tension, doesn't make the other one go away, but you sort of bounce between the two and it can just be a way to balance it out. Mm-hmm. So, but I just wanted to acknowledge that.
Oh, I appreciate that. And I actually have something to say about that too, that someone posted something on Twitter that I cannot get out of my mind. It's been several days now. She said, some of us who have extreme trauma are actually finding the current moment easier to deal with. Because it's almost as though the external world has finally come to match internal world.
Right.
And I found that quite compelling, actually. That uh-huh. And it made me kind of revisit the level of trauma that I live with. Because in some ways, I was like, whoa, I get that. I get that. That it's almost like And then she proceeded in the thread to articulate some ways that this is the case, and said, you know, this complete, we don't know what's going to happen next. We're being lied to. Everything, there's great danger around us all the time. That actually these are things that like are kind of my day-to-day normal state. Mm-hmm. And so this actually kind of, in a weird way, makes more sense. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I wanted to just throw that out there. I thought that was also a really interesting comment.
Yeah. So I just want to, I mean, I think that we can think of a lot of people who actually this exact moment is replicates. So I've been thinking so much about the queers of the 80s, right? I've been thinking about so much of coming of age in 1980, 81. Mm-hmm. And I keep thinking about the people I know who are still alive, mm-hmm. who are saying, you know, who are watching the president lie, who are watching people die, and who are, and, you know, people running around like their hair's on fire saying, I can't believe the president's lying. And I think, why? Why do you not believe that?
Right.
They're going to let Americans die. They're mm-hmm. saying Americans could die. Yeah. And I think, you know, I think I can imagine that basically every single, you know, black person saying, yeah, the government will kill you. Mm-hmm. Okay. Huh. Anyway.
Yeah.
Moving
the
on.
The government doesn't care if you live.
Right. And will actively pursue
your death. Yeah.
So, you know, for every single person who came across the border without documentation, who watched the laws say people can't leave water in the desert, mm-hmm. they'll let you die. Mm-hmm. So
they want you to die.
Right. So I think that I think for all those people, there's this also, so yes, people are understanding what I've been living with, but there's also this like, nice of you to catch up.
Mm-hmm.
So totally. I think it's incredible. That's what he's talking about, these multiple griefs. Because mm-hmm. I can see, mm-hmm. for me, mm-hmm. it brings back up the whole thing of all the people I buried in 1980, yeah. 81, 82, yeah. 80, whatever, however many years, mm-hmm. and thinking...
When you lived in...
San Francisco.
Yeah. San Francisco.
And that bringing that all back up again. So there's a dual grief, like yes, you're back in that.
Of course.
And you're like, oh, you didn't pay attention to it then.
Right. Which is how grief works.
Right.
So one grief will reawaken an older grief.
Right. So we just get back to that whole thing again for me, which is where we watch, you know, cisgendered white people, especially, you know, middle class white people. Straight white people. Just like, I don't know. There's a level of freak out that it's like, yeah. You know what? You're making me tired. Yeah. Here's what you can do. Do this, do this, do this. Build right. community.
Right.
Listen to the people around you. Protect your own and mm-hmm. and wash your hands.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. I think it's so complicated, and it's why I thought this article was so good. And I really mm-hmm. want to recommend that you guys all go take a look at it, because, you know, we've just sort of touched on it. And I think...
But absolutely. I mean, I just want to bring this up to date as of I'm sorry, I've forgotten the date today, but yesterday, the day before, just in the last probably 48 hours, the widespread narrative has shifted. About 3 or 4 days ago, the administration was calling this a war that we had to win. And then coming from the fringes of the right came the narrative, the cure can't be worse than the disease. And very, very quickly, that has become mainstream. And Trump has adopted it. And I'm bringing this up right now. I don't want to take this into a whole political realm. But, and then the deputy governor of Texas came on and said, old people should be happy to die for their grandchildren and should be happy to die for the economy.
Yeah. And pretty soon. I don't think he said happy, but I think
he said a lot of things.
He would be happy to.
Yeah. And then a whole bunch of other people chimed in, and it's become the new talking point that old people should be thrilled to die for the economy, for the stock market. And I just want to say that the life or death level discourse, you live, you die. You're permitted to live, you're permitted to die. You're worthy of life, you're not worthy of life. That was much more latent for a lot of middle class cisgender straight white people has burst into visibility.
Yeah.
It's being spoken openly. And, you know, cisgender, straight, middle-class white people are not used to being told, especially if they're only, you know, the ones who are like 65, you know, it's like, they're like the, you know, incredibly entitled baby boomers, you know, they're like, excuse me, like, say what now?
But then I can, you know, well, maybe we shouldn't go in this digression, but I also think that, that it's so class-based and it's so everything-based, because we were having a family phone call last night with my folks who are late 70s, early 80s, grew up poor / working class, have worked very hard, and were born rounding third base because they're white, and have a comfortable life. Their kids all eventually graduated from college. I waited quite a while, but I got there.
Got there in the end.
Don't start. All of their grandchildren have are either in college or have graduated from mm-hmm. college. And one of my nephews was on the call, and he was saying that there was a contract and a clause in his contract about a national emergency and how the contract could be terminated for a national emergency. Hmm. And one of my parents said, well, I'd die to keep your job. So, I mean, I think that they're a little bit more realistic. I mean, they're like, look, our time is short.
Mm-hmm.
If this is going to be the difference between my grandchildren's well-being, so I can.
Well,
so
I just want to. Really sorry. I mean, that just makes me go all Bernie. Which, by the way, and I can't. I'm just going to say it. I can't stand Bernie, although I really like his policies. But that's a whole other thing. But I'm just like, God,
why you got to light that
did
fire?
Did we reach a state where? No, I want to continue my thought. Where this has become the zero sum game. This has become, you know, we only have two choices: old people die or young people work. And the stock market's okay.
Like,
I'm so appalled right now.
I'm not saying that it was a reasonable statement. What I'm saying is that there's a whole group of people who've worked very hard to get their families to a particular place, who don't want it to go away. So there's that. Now I will put a giant, you know, whatever around that saying. Because we don't have decent healthcare, mm-hmm. because we have, you know, capitalism run amok.
Yeah. How about minimum wage? How about universal income?
I'm for all of those mm-hmm. things. I'm talking about here in this present moment. There's a whole bunch of shit wrong. I mean, mm-hmm. I think the beauty of this moment and I always hesitate to say those things because it sounds like everything happens for a reason. That's not what I mean. What I keep trying to remind myself of is this is never going to be the same.
Mm-hmm.
So it's on me to envision what I want it to be. Mm-hmm. And in this chaos, work for that.
Mm-hmm.
To say, okay, then let's keep pushing for this and this and this. So
yeah. And we have like Britney Spears calling for, you know, universal basic income.
Right.
And, you know, all these other people. And it's not just her. I'm blanking, unfortunately, on a couple other highly unlikely sources who said, you know, basically we need to overthrow the system.
Right. And I think that in this, it's very, very hard to stay collective when you are individually panicked. And so to keep reminding yourself, I just keep going back to the 80s and I keep going back to ACT UP and mm-hmm. I keep going back to everybody fighting for a collective good.
Mm-hmm.
And so this, we do have this opportunity to fight for a collective good.
Yes.
And I think you're absolutely right. It's horrifying that where we are in the wealthiest country in the world
mm-hmm.
is to say, well, you two old people, we'll trade you for his job.
Mm-hmm.
It's just bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
What I was fascinated by was how complex that answer is mm-hmm. based on where the life you come from,
yeah.
what you're willing to give up to keep your family okay.
Yeah.
Which is why we gave up all of our freaking civil rights following 9/11 and why we're in danger of those things right now with the Department of Justice doing all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And we've gone into a whole political thing when we were just going to talk about grief.
Well, but I, as far as I'm concerned, I think it's really worth, I think it's part of the grief.
It's for me. Right. For me, it's compounding old grief.
Well,
But it's also this grief of it is all happening so fast and mm-hmm. there are people with so much power and I can't, mm-hmm. you know, we can't collectively gather and march together, right? Not that I think that at this point protest is the most effective thing mm-hmm. and we can certainly still make phone calls,
mm-hmm.
but really, what are we going to do?
Well, you know, for me, one of the traumas of my life was growing up in a family of gaslighters. And that's a big part of my trigger. That's a, one of the things is, in fact, I actually someday maybe I'll write about this, is when the professors in started and I said, my job is to tell you the truth. My job is to tell you the truth. And that mission of the professor is in comes directly from my childhood trauma of that I grew up in an environment where no one ever told the truth, ever. And so Trump is quite triggering to me because he won't tell the truth, and we are, and it's gaslighting on a massive scale. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like the personal is political in the classic formulation, but in so many ways. Anyway, to just to wrap up with Kessler, he says that the reason he proposed the sixth stage was to one more way to deal with grief, and that is to find meaning in it. So meaning. After acceptance, there's meaning. And I love that because acceptance is a little bit kind of like passive-ish, whereas making meaning is entirely active. It's finding meaning in the experience. And of course, this is premature. We cannot yet find meaning in this experience, I think, but we can certainly look toward it. And I think what you're saying is that. Envision the life that you might want to have, the world that you want to come out of this. That's making meaning. That's Kessler's sixth element or whatever stage of grief. And so, yeah, no one's urging it. And I'm not certainly not telling our listeners that they should be there now or whenever this podcast comes out. But at least it's something to stick into the mix and engage with it. And then, you know, but as you deal with it, please don't squelch your grief or any of your fear or anger or any of the emotions. Don't squelch them. Don't let anyone tell you to squelch them. Or suppress them. Just sit, be, wow, I am sad. Wow, I am scared. Wow, I am angry.
And just to remind you that the article is in the Harvard Business Review. It appeared on March 23rd, 2020, and the title is The Discomfort You're Feeling is Grief. So check it out and pop on over to one of our social media feeds and have a conversation with us about it, because by the time this comes out, who knows what we'll be grieving. Stay safe, everybody.